Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar series, where great professors teach you. My name is Richard Poe, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled Heaven in a Wildflower, The British Romantic Poets. Your professor will be Adam Potke. Professor Potke teaches English at the College of William and Mary, and has been a visiting professor at Columbia University and at the University of Aberdeen, Scotland. He received his B.A. from Cornell University, an M.A. from Johns Hopkins University, and his Ph.D. from Rutgers University. Professor Potke's publications include The Passion for Happiness, Samuel Johnson and David Hume, and The Fate of Eloquence in the Age of Hume. Professor Potke was recently named a co-winner of the Harry Levin Prize, awarded by the American Comparative Literature Association for his book The Story of Joy, From the Bible to Late Romanticism. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites and a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students. And now we begin Heaven in a Wildflower, The British Romantic Poets. Lecture 1. What is Romanticism?
Romantic poetry is, first and foremost, about how we see or perceive the world, about how imagination, intuition, and memory shape our perceptions of the world. Romantic poetry thus offers the possibility of a new world in seeing the world anew. This is the theme of many of the best-known lines of romantic verse. For example, William Blake's desire, "To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. We are led to believe a lie when we see not through the eye." That is, when we see with the eye, not through it, to an imaginative or spiritual realm. Or take these lines from William Wordsworth, recollecting the seemingly supernatural light that bathed all of nature in early childhood. "There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth and every common sight, to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and freshness of a dream. It is not now, as it has been of yore. Turn where'er so I may, by night or day, the things which I have seen, I now can see no more." Wordsworth later asks, "Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory and the dream?" He concludes, hopefully, that something of this gleam can be recaptured through recollections of childhood, and also that adulthood brings additional goods of its own: sympathy with other people, the compassion that comes from having experienced suffering and seeing death. What Wordsworth and Blake are offering us, what indeed most all the romantic poets offer us, are glimpses of a new and better world, one in which the things of nature take on a supernatural gleam, or, conversely, in which supernatural things, such as spirits and magical forces, seem a part of nature. This natural supernaturalism, as we may call it, is embodied in a work that is a cornerstone of the Romantic movement, the volume of poems titled Lyrical Ballads, jointly written by Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Originally published in 1798, it was revised and expanded in 1800. Of this volume, Coleridge later wrote, quote, "It was agreed between myself and Wordsworth that my endeavors should be directed to persons and characters supernatural, or at least romantic." Let me pause there to say that Coleridge uses that word romantic in the sense of deriving from old chivalric or heroic romances. That is, tales of heroes and knights, and their often marvelous adventures. First, let me return to Coleridge. Quote, "My endeavors should be directed to persons and characters supernatural, or at least romantic, yet so as to transfer from our inward nature a human interest in a semblance of truth sufficient to procure for these shadows of imagination that willing suspension of disbelief which constitutes poetic faith." Mr. Wordsworth, on the other hand, was to give the charm of novelty to things of every day, and to excite a feeling analogous to the supernatural by awakening the mind's attention from the lethargy of custom and directing it to the loveliness and the wonders of the world before us. Let me repeat that last clause because it's so key. Wordsworth's aim of giving charm to things of every day and to excite a feeling analogous to the supernatural by awakening the mind's attention from the lethargy of custom, customary ways of viewing the world, and directing it to the loveliness and the wonders of the world before us. In this course, we shall inquire into how well Coleridge's account of giving things supernatural a natural interest and giving the things of nature a supernatural interest characterizes the poetry of the period as a whole. What the Romantics also offer us is a heaven of sound in the richness and sonorousness of their poetry, arguably the richest poetry written in the history of English. Shakespeare is, of course, the greatest of English dramatic poets, but for non-dramatic poetry, that is, for lyrics and odes and descriptive and meditative verse, there is no finer place to turn than to the pages of the British Romantics. Now, these pages are meant to be read aloud. Romantic poems aren't suited for silent reading, but for recitation, for declamation. Thus, they are well suited for an audio course such as ours, which allows you to hear them. Indeed, sound is often as important as sense in the poems we'll be covering. In one of Wordsworth's most popular poems, The Solitary Reaper, we find described a song that matters even without verbal meaning. The poem's speaker, traveling in the Scottish Highlands, hears a girl singing in Gaelic, a language he doesn't understand, and responds to the richness of her sound with glorious sounds of his own. The poem begins. Behold her single in the field, yon solitary Highland lass, reaping and singing by herself, stop here or gently pass. Alone she cuts and binds the grain and sings a melancholy strain. Oh, listen, for the vale profound is overflowing with the sound. And note that final rhyme, profound, sound, the assonance or vowel repetition between profound and sound. The assonance or repetition that draws attention to the very sound of sound. Now, as important as hearing these poems is, let me add that some of their subtleties may best be appreciated by supplementing your audio experience with reading them on your own. Although the poems covered in our course are readily available on the internet, ideally you should read them in a well-annotated print anthology of Romantic literature, and I'll suggest such an anthology or two in the suggested reading appendix to this lecture in your course booklet. Now we turn to the basic question, who are the Romantic poets, and why are they now called Romantic? I should begin by noting that in their own day, roughly the 50-year period from 1785 to 1835, they weren't called Romantics. There was no recognized group of writers referred to as the Romantics. It's not as though we're talking here about a group such as the Beatles, with its readily identifiable members, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Indeed, as we've seen above in my quotation from Coleridge, the word romantic referred, around 1820, to something having the characteristics of the ancient or medieval romances, that is, tales of marvels and often of monsters, of heroes and knights and their quests, trials, and adventures. As we'll see in later lectures, some romances had a dark edge, revolving around betrayal and vengeance, sin and penance. Recall Coleridge on the poems he contributed to lyrical ballads, as he said, quote, "My endeavors were directed to persons and characters supernatural, or at least romantic." As we'll see later in these lectures, Coleridge's supernatural or romantic characters included the Ancient Mariner, a man who as a young sailor had shot an albatross and whose ship was thereafter subject to evil or avenging spirits on the open seas. This was the stuff of literary romance, a genre Coleridge revived and transformed. Since such romantic tales were not always to the polite taste of the prior age, the 18th century or Age of Enlightenment, the very word romantic could in Coleridge's day still be used as a pejorative or a bad word, meaning excessive, extravagant, fantastical. The word did not have its current connotations of amorousness, dim lighting, as when we now say, let's have a romantic dinner. And so it's important to keep in mind that the Romantics aren't called romantic because they wrote love poetry. Indeed, excepting the great Scottish poet Robert Burns, who may or may not be considered a romantic, the Romantic poets wrote quite little love poetry. So how did the Romantic poets get to be called Romantic poets? The answer is that they were so called by later Victorian-era writers. The label comes from the later 19th century. And it was applied because of the elements of medievalism, supernaturalism, and dark passion found in at least some of the works of most of the major romantics, from Burns onwards. Now then, who are the romantic poets? I personally am inclined to include Robert Burns among their number, and will be addressing Burns in my next lecture. But this number, somewhat arbitrarily established by critical consensus in the early 20th century, was 6. And these 6 are the Big 6, in chronological order: Blake, Wordsworth, and Coleridge, Byron, Shelley, and Keats. And let me repeat that, because it's good to keep this in mind: Blake, Wordsworth, and Coleridge, Byron, Shelley, and Keats. Blake, the eldest of these, was born in 1757. Burns, who I'd consider a 7th romantic poet, was born 2 years later in 1759. Wordsworth and Coleridge are the next wave, born respectively in 1770 and 1772. And finally, there's the so-called second generation of English romantics, Romanticism, the next generation, that includes Lord Byron, born 1788, Percy Bysshe Shelley, born 1792, and John Keats, born 1795. By 1834, all the romantics of both generations were dead, except for Wordsworth, who lingered on for another 16 years without writing much of note. And thus scholars usually give some point in the 1830s as the end of the Romantic era in Britain. Although, as we've seen, it was only writers of the 1830s and later who retrospectively constituted a Romantic literature in English. In the lectures that follow, I will be looking at the lives, and especially at select poems, by each of these 7 romantic poets. In the rest of this first lecture, I'd like to consider some of the common bonds of the romantic poets, some of the characteristics and concerns that helped to bind their works together in ways that, at least retrospectively, constitute a literary movement. In this section, I'll talk about the Romantics and the French Revolution. There is, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, a shared interest in nature and the supernatural, in the divine or supernatural forces that may animate nature, and in the psychology of our supernatural imaginings. But what the Romantics and their immediate successors recognized as the primary motive of the new literary movement was, rather, political, namely, the hopes inspired by the French Revolution. The French Revolution, you'll recall, began with the fall of the Bastille in July 1789, and came to an end with the final fall of Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo in June 1815. In its early years, at least, the French Revolution held out an unprecedented promise to Republican sympathizers throughout Europe. It was seen by its French supporters and English and American sympathizers as the possibility of totally restructuring society according to a rational and just scheme. Totally restructuring society is what I want to emphasize here. In this, the French Revolution could be seen as something closer to the Russian Revolution of 1917, the advent of the communist experiment in Europe, than to the so-called American Revolution, which, however much lauded, could also be construed in a conservative light as a war of secession, which set out to preserve the ancient rights and liberties of Englishmen, which Lord North and George III were radically trying to deny them. The American War of Independence could also be viewed as commercially motivated, a war fought in the interests of a maritime merchant class. This was, at least, how Coleridge tended to view the American Revolution. The French Revolution was, by contrast, avowedly idealistic. Its famous principles were, you know the mantra, liberty, fraternity, and equality, and the French National Assembly hoped to implement these in a novel, thoroughgoing, and rational way. In the eyes of many French patriots, especially in the period 1792 to 95, the new age of liberty and equality would need to be ushered in by a good deal of creative destruction. The monarchy, aristocracy, and clergy would all have to go, and they weren't going to go quietly. Christianity itself might need to be uprooted and replaced with some more rational civic religion. Here's a list of some of the more memorable acts of the National Convention of 1792 to 95, the longest lived of the revolutionary assemblies, to give you a sense of what the French Revolution was all about. With regard to the calendar system, the AD system that we still have, Anno Domini, Year of Our Lord, was abandoned, precisely because it was the Year of Our Lord. And September 22, 1792, according to the old AD system, was declared the first day of the first month of Year One of Equality. The months of the revolutionary calendar were given new and rational names, divorced from the tyrant emperors and pagan gods who give us most of our European calendar. Thus, for example, the month beginning in July, named after Julius Caesar, was renamed Thermidor, the hot one. The month beginning at the end of August, from Augustus Caesar, became Fructidor, the fruitful one. Springtime began not with our March, named after Mars, the god of war, but rather with germinal, or seed time. All in all, you see, a wholly rational system. As for the monarchy and aristocracy, they had to go too. On January 21, 1793, King Louis the 16th was executed, beheaded at the guillotine. The period 1793-94 is known as the Reign of Terror because the National Convention, dominated by Robespierre, suppressed counter-revolutionary movements with an iron fist, shedding an ocean of blood. Indeed, our modern sense of terrorism derives from this period. On November 10, 1793, to turn back to religion, the worship of God was abolished. Notre Dame Cathedral was renamed the Temple of Reason, the seat of the cult of the Goddess of Reason, and Christmas became the festival of the Supreme Being. Finally, as a little side note you might find interesting, the French of the 1790s gave us the metric system of measurement, another rational scheme that, perhaps for its very rationality, the English, and especially the Americans, have never entirely accepted. We still like our inches, pounds, miles, and gallons. Anyhow, to return us to the 1790s, just to give you a sense of how heady these times are, imagine how excited the idealistic youth of Europe must have been to see these world-transforming events unfold before them. The closest thing to it in our recent memory may have been growing up in the 1960s between civil rights and student protest, with psychedelia and hard rock coming in between. As we'll see, those coming of age in the 1960s often look back to the Romantic poets, especially Blake, as spiritual ancestors. But for now, let's hear the Romantics, the first children of the Revolution, speak for themselves. Take Wordsworth's lines on what it was like to have faith in the French Republic in the early 1790s. Wordsworth, writing in his 30s, is looking back here to how he felt as a young man in his 20s. Quote, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. O times in which the meager, stale, forbidding ways of custom, law, and statute took at once the attraction of a country in romance, when reason seemed the most to assert her rights, when most intent on making of herself a prime enchanter to assist the work which was then going forward in her name. Not favored spots alone, but the whole earth the beauty wore of promise, that which sets the budding rose above the rose full blown." Wonderful final image, the beauty of promise, why we love budding roses more than full-blown ones, because they're still coming into being. And this is how Wordsworth felt about the political ferment of his own time, something new coming into being. Also note Wordsworth's earlier image in that speech about the political state taking on the attraction of a country in romance, presumably medieval romance, where reason itself such as the French Cult of Reason, seems paradoxically an enchanter, a Merlin figure, enchanting the imaginative youth of Europe. It was, in this sense, a romantic age. Wordsworth then goes on about these romantic youths, among whom Wordsworth includes his earlier self. They were called upon to exercise their political schemes, quote, not in utopia, but in the very world which is the world of all of us, the place on which, in the end, we find our happiness, or not at all. The possibility of radically transforming the world, turning it into a world of justice, peace, and joy, is what Wordsworth is talking about here. But note, too, Wordsworth's insistence that he is talking about this world, the world of all of us, the natural world, and not an impossible utopia or religious other world. However, as I want to argue next, the very habit of imagining a new and perfective world is itself deeply ingrained in Hebrew and Christian scriptures. And thus what the Romantics did in their early enthusiasm for the French Revolution was to transfer their culture's supernatural expectations of a future paradise into more or less natural terms, with Europe transformed into the promised land. In the Bible, apocalyptic expectations begin with the Hebrew prophets, especially Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 11, the prophet foretells a future perfectly just ruler who will restore Edenic peace. As in Eden, animals won't even fight with or eat one another, but rather cuddle up together. This is from Isaiah. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. This theme is developed further toward the end of Isaiah, where God proclaims, quote, for behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come to mind. The new heavens and new earth of the Romantics, their heaven in a wildflower, may or may not include a god who presides over all, but it most certainly does not include the late feudal judicature of the English legal system as they knew it. And, as in revolutionary France, it does not include Christian priests. Blake couldn't be more emphatic about this at the end of his poem Song of Liberty, where the fiery spirit of the revolution, quote, stamps the stony law to dust, that law being either civil or religious, quote, stamps the stony law to dust, loosing the eternal horses from the dens of night, crying, empire is no more, and now the lion and wolf shall cease. Note that what they'll do is cease praying and destroying. All shall enjoy that peace foretold by Isaiah. Blake then adds, in a final chorus, addressing, quote, the priests of the ravens of the dawn, i.e., priests dressed in black, and also priests who plunder and devour the people. The word raven as a verb means to consume greedily or devour. Back to Blake, quote, let the priests of the raven of the dawn, no longer in deadly black, with hoarse notes, curse the sons of joy, for everything that lives is holy. At about the same time, Robert Burns wrote his most radical piece, a ballad opera known either as Love and Liberty or The Jolly Beggars, which ends with his drunken beggars defiantly singing in chorus, a fig for those by law protected, liberty's a glorious feast. Courts for cowards were erected, churches built to please the priest. Wordsworth and Coleridge, both of whom would by 1798 distance themselves from their early revolutionary enthusiasm, began as radicals of a still more rabid stripe, still more radical because more clearly apocalyptic. For them, the violence unfolding under the Terror in France was a necessary and cleansing violence, the destruction of an old world so that a new world could arise in its place. The model for their thinking was the last book of the Christian Bible, the Revelation of St. John the Divine. What's revealed to St. John is a vision of spectacular violence, warfare, famine, meteorological disasters, etc., after which the old earth passes away. Alluding back to Isaiah, St. John writes at the end of the Christian Bible, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and first earth were passed away." Wordsworth, writing of France in 1793, sees in its violence the promise, precisely such a new earth. Quote from Wordsworth, "Lo, from the innocuous flames a lovely birth, with its own virtues springs another earth." That's from his poem Descriptive Sketches. Coleridge, who much admired Wordsworth's early lines, wrote with similar sentiments a year later, at the height of the terror in France. Coleridge addresses the lowly and wretched of our corrupt social order, aged women, he writes, loathly suppliants, poor widows, and so forth, and assures them, in a preacher's way, that the end is near. Here's Coleridge from his poem Religious Musings. "Rest a while, children of wretchedness, more groans must rise, more blood must steam, or ere your wrongs be full. Yet is the day of retribution nigh. The Lamb of God hath opened the fifth seal, and upward rush on swiftest wing of fire the innumerable multitudes of wrongs by man on man afflicted. Rest a while, children of wretchedness. The hour is nigh, and lo, the great, the rich, the mighty men, the kings and the chief captains of the world, with all that fixed on high like stars of heaven shot baleful influence, shall be cast to earth, vile and downtrodden as the untimely fruit shook from the fig tree by a sudden storm. Even now the storm begins." Coleridge alludes here to another passage from the book of Revelation, chapter 6, "And the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind." And Coleridge provides his own footnote here to the passage I just read. He writes, quote, "This passage alludes to the French Revolution, the sudden storm that will cast down the mighty and allow the lowly to rise up." Now, although Wordsworth and Coleridge would later renounce their early revolutionary enthusiasm, they would come to reject this earlier revolutionary stance they shared. It could be, and was in their own time argued, that their mature poetry carried on French revolutionary principles by other means. First of all, they were seen as anti-authoritarian poets, poets who asserted their own genius, their own innovations against established poetic practice. And second, Wordsworth in particular sought to lend a dignity and a quality to the common man, especially the rural folk of his native Lake District, a beautiful and mountainous, but then very poor and remote region of northwestern England. A 20th century U.S. equivalent would be Appalachia. These points about the anti-authoritarianism, the revolutionary principles of the early Romantic poets, were made against Wordsworth and Coleridge in particular by William Hazlitt, a contemporary of theirs. In 1818, Hazlitt writes, with gusto, if with overstatement, quote, "Our poetic literature had, toward the close of the 1700s, degenerated into the most trite, insipid, and mechanical of things. It wanted something to stir it up, and it found that something in the principles of the French Revolution. From the impulse it thus received, it rose at once from the most servile imitation and tamest commonplace to the utmost pitch of singularity and paradox. The change in literature was as complete, and to many persons as startling, as the change in politics, with which it went hand in hand. There was a mighty ferment in the heads of statesmen and poets, kings and people. According to the prevailing notions, all was to be natural and new. Nothing that was established was to be tolerated. All the commonplace figures of poetry, with the whole heathen mythology, were instantly discarded. kings and queens were dethroned from their rank and station in legitimate tragedy or epic poetry, as they were elsewhere decapitated, and regular meter was abolished along with regular government. Authority and fashion, elegance or arrangement, were hooted out of countenance as pedantry and prejudice. Everyone did that which was good in his own eyes. The world was to be turned topsy-turvy, and poetry, by the goodwill of our Adamwits, was to share its fate and begin anew. It was a time of promise, a renewal of the world and of letters. In short, just as the French Revolution held the promise of creating the world anew, the literature we now call romantic would seek to create literature anew. Let me explain one line of Hazlitt's. Quote, kings and queens were dethroned from their rank and station in legitimate tragedy or epic poetry, as they were decapitated elsewhere. Well, we know they were decapitated in France. But what does it mean that kings and queens were dethroned from their proper place in literature? Well, according to classical literary decorum, which was in place through the 18th century, the highest forms of literature, tragedy and epic, dealt with the highest ranks of society, kings, generals, heroes. Thus, Shakespeare's tragedies, as you know, concern royal or noble figures. Prince Hamlet, King Lear. The flip side of this decorum is that the lower ranks, laborers, craftsmen, farmers, were fit to be represented only in low literary forms such as comedy and satire. The lower ranks, from the ancient Greeks and Romans through Shakespeare, are inherently fumbling, bumbling, slangy, and comic, such as the workmen who put on a disastrously bad play in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. Yet Wordsworth, like Burns before him, turns this around, offering sympathetic and ennobling views of common people, farm laborers, artisans, shepherds, the aged. And in Wordsworth, who took this to an extreme, very small children, even idiots and the insane, are granted dignity and high poetry. By giving such characters dignity and poetry, Wordsworth overturned established decorum, effectively extending the revolutionary's principles of fraternity and equality to his own poetic practice. Thus Hazlitt's remark that for the Lake District poets, kings and queens had all been guillotined. Thus the French Revolution was, in one sense, quote, the master theme of the epic in which we live, as Shelley later put it. Of all the romantic poets, only Keats was, at least apparently, apolitical, or at least apparently uninterested in the legacy of the French Revolution. But seen from another angle, the democratizing ideals of the French Revolution simply reinforced an element of British literature apparent since the 1760s, since quite a while earlier. And that element is this, a new interest in the common people and their literary production. A new interest in the common people and their literary production. I want to emphasize that. Interests in folklore, in older English ballads, in poetry written in regional dialects. All of these were well in place by the time that Wordsworth and Coleridge started writing. And it is to this folk revival that I will turn in my next lecture on the ballad tradition and the poet Robert Burns.
This ends Lecture 1.